One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hey, everybody. We got a great one today. You know, for a change, because Dr. Atul Gawande is my guest. Atul is one of our great Americans, a surgeon, professor at Harvard Medical School, author of four New York Times bestsellers. And for 3 years, he was the assistant administrator of USAID's Bureau of Global Health. USAID is an amazing organization which has saved millions upon millions of lives overseas since President John F. Kennedy established it in 1961. And as you may know, Trump and Musk have all but shut USAID down, which means that millions will die overseas who would otherwise have lived but for Trump and Musk, the richest man in the world, killing millions of the poorest people in the world. You see, Musk called USAID a criminal enterprise. A little bleak, but in case you want yet another reason to hate Trump and Musk, today's podcast is your ticket. Of course, there is the matter of the tariffs. On Liberation Day, Trump laid out his tariff program and said it was not subject to negotiation. Remember, he said he wouldn't negotiate. And then he started to negotiate. Then he said again that he wouldn't negotiate. Then he started to negotiate again. Then this past Wednesday, he caved after the bonds market went nuts. And then the stock market had its best day since 2008, only after having its worst day since the height of the pandemic. So now we supposedly have maybe, 80 some days until Trump tells us what he's doing. In the meantime, every American in the market has lost money, unless I guess you were short selling. At the beginning of 2025, the International Monetary Fund put out its economic forecast for the coming year. The U.S. economy, they said, was in better shape than just about all others, and now it's even odds that we're going into a recession. We are not going to fully recover from this. In the New York Times, Tom Friedman said this is Trump's equivalent of Biden's botched exit from Afghanistan, from which he never fully recovered, except this will have lasting effects on every American's pocketbook. Trump will never recover from this. Will our economy recover? That's the question. And why have we alienated every other country in the world, including our friends? You can blame that on Donald Trump and Donald Trump alone. Atul Gawande joins me. We start by discussing healthcare reform. I promise it's interesting. And then go into the travesty of the near eradication of USAID. It's critical we don't let this get lost in the muck of all Trump's other horrors. And it's a great one. You know, for a change.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.com. SI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hey, everybody. It's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
I think we first met in 2009. Is that kind of correct?
You know, I don't remember. You know, I was on Air America.
You were? Okay, then it was before
one time. And so I think we met then, way back in that time. There was a couple times you had me on.
Oh, okay. Well, then I met you before. But in 2009, you had written this article in the New Yorker about McAllen, Texas. And this is a city in, right on the border, right, of Mexico. And it had very expensive health care.
Most expensive community for health care, for Medicare per person in the United States.
And this is a very poor county too, right?
That's right. I compared it to El Paso, Texas, that also was a poor county and also a border community and had half of the cost per person for healthcare with better outcomes. You're talking about, like, in McAllen at that time, it was 2 to 3 times the number of cardiac catheterizations, ultrasounds, and other kinds of tests and procedures. I went there to talk to the doctors in the community to understand what's the difference? What's happening here?
And El Paso did it not unlike the Mayo Clinic.
Well,
in terms of the way they've charged.
Yes, I mean I brought places like the Mayo Clinic or Kaiser Permanente and others into the picture because they had approaches to try to control overuse, unnecessary care, which was, I found, and people in the community in McAllen reported to me, there was a vast business that had really developed in healthcare, and the business incentives had overcome the professional incentives.
So this is like a corporate healthcare model.
Yes, and you had active management scooping up people to get home healthcare that was unnecessary or other kinds of care, and there were many in the community. Clinicians, physicians, nurses who saw that it was happening and were extremely concerned about it. And, you know, I pointed to other places. So El Paso just didn't have as gung-ho a business community driven around driving up use. I think in some ways my concerns is that I don't think this issue has gotten any better. If anything, many health systems and organizations have gotten better at extracting money from people and their insurance coverage. McCallum, 5 years later, had the arrival of primary care clinics and systems that actually dramatically lowered the costs, and there were some prosecutions in McAllen. And so McAllen, you know, moved out of being an outlier where it was for a decade or more to moving closer to El Paso.
Did you feel that your article had any effect over the debate in the Affordable Care Act?
It was striking to me. So it was an experience like I've never had. President Obama at that time read it. They were formulating the Affordable Care Act.
I had just gotten there, I think. I think he wrote this in like June or something like that, or it's in the June issue. And I got there in July.
Yeah, it was early in that year, the first half of the year. And what was recognized was it wasn't going to be enough just to finance healthcare, that you needed to have approaches that brought prices as well as overuse under control or inappropriate use under control. And the creation of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation really came out of that effort to reward places for arriving at better outcomes of care per dollar. That still is is the holy grail, finding ways to do that. Mm-hmm. There's lots I learned at USAID that I thought was really powerful about the ways that that can be done. But in the decade since then, it's been more than a decade and a half, healthcare was going straight up as a percentage of GDP. And it's been paused around 18% of GDP instead of, you know, it had gone up by almost a third to a half percent of the entire economy of the United States, you know, every year or two. Mm-hmm. And had progressed. I remember under Bill Clinton in the early 90s, it was 12%. It became 18%, was projected to get to 20% within a few years back in 2009, 2010. And I do think we've seen some changes that have moderated that. And so it has not grown as a percentage of the economy. Now, we could get so much more out of that kind of spending.
Well, it's still amazing that we're the only developed country without universal healthcare.
Yes, and even the Affordable Care Act approach that we have, we still have the average worker has a $2,500 deductible or more in the country in order to have coverage. So even those who have coverage still are often left feeling that they're not able to afford basics.
That's maybe one of the reasons why the Affordable Care Act wasn't popular politically until Trump tried to replace it. And then that bill was terrible. A lot of people would have lost their health care. And they didn't even necessarily, states could actually opt out of saying that the insurance had to cover everything.
Yeah, there have been multiple bites at the apple of repealing the Affordable Care Act.
That was in 17, they tried. But for John McCain, they would have passed one.
That's right. You know, once implemented, here's a basic, right? My son has a congenital heart condition, and getting a pre-existing condition that would have made him unqualified for healthcare on the free market, you know, as we constituted it. The Affordable Care Act got rid of pre-existing condition exclusions in order to access insurance.
Right. So because of the Affordable Care Act, he can go on the market.
That's right. And
right.
And could access, but it's a different market, right? It's you can buy it through healthcare.gov and get coverage, or through an employer. And that's a really important thing that huge numbers of people, anybody with diabetes, anybody with high blood pressure, anybody with any major condition, simply couldn't get coverage. And we don't have those horror stories anymore. And people are unwilling to give that up for good reason.
And that was huge.
Absolutely huge. And people appreciate having the kind of coverage that we have. What we don't have good access to is basic primary care, you know, having a regular touch point with a clinician that you know, where you don't have a massive deductible to pay in order to come in because you have a cough or a fever.
How many Americans don't have that?
It's estimated around half of Americans do not have regular access to a primary health care specialist and are obtaining care in very fragmented ways. And that means you're being left out of all of the benefits of a consistent relationship with a clinician, which include chronic illness management and control. You know, we'll get to the USAID part, but I was in a number of countries that have graduated from foreign assistance, where we had assisted them to build their own health coverage systems. And some of them chose, they choose what they want to choose. Some of them chose to start with, because when you don't have enough money, you have to make choices. Instead of starting with covering hospital care first, which is the thing that bankrupts people, right? So there's a logic to saying, I want to cover the hospital costs first. Instead, they started by saying, we're going to assure universal coverage to primary care, your first point of contact for your care, and making essential medicines like insulin and high blood pressure medicines and even HIV medicines that are essential for prevention and chronic illness management, made them free. And the result is Costa Rica, you know, progressed to having not only independence of needing foreign assistance, but ended up with the longest life expect among the longest in the entire Americas. They're
in Latin America.
82 years, yeah, in Latin America, North and South America, not just Latin America.
Right.
That they outpace the United States
really
on a sixth of our spending per person. I was in Thailand, where they went from having a third of their deaths in any given year occurring in people under the age of 50 in the space of about 20 years, advancing to the point that they now nearly match U.S. life expectancy, have universal primary care, universal dental care on $300 per person per year. Now, their specialized care and access to, you know, the most advanced cancer care and so on is not what we would expect here. But they are getting longer life expectancy through simply being healthy, having healthier options and easier access to primary care in the front door for very low amounts of money. And those are things that are still the steps. You know, we're not talking about this enough, right? We're in the middle of culture wars and battles over democracy.
Yeah, it's just even talking about this right now feels like we haven't had this conversation at all in years. I mean,
that's right.
When Trump tried to remember, when it failed, he said, who knew healthcare was so complicated?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, one of the most important things, like you do polls, and what did people say coming out of the last election? That it's pocketbook issues and that nobody's paying attention to the two things that make it impossible to live a middle-class life on a non-college education. And that is housing and healthcare. And the core issues on healthcare are the massive deductibles and coinsurance. For 3 years, I worked with Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JP Morgan. And one of the things we did around healthcare was I was interested because they had a low wage population, you know, lots of people who were, you know, making $20 or so an hour in warehouses or data centers or carpet factories, et cetera. And we designed a plan that got rid of the deductible, got rid of the coinsurance on primary care. Instead, primary care was just a copay, $15, 60 drugs free, paid for it by saying, okay, the ambulance ride for a hospital is going to be $500, $1,000 for an admission to a hospital, but your basic everyday care is prioritized. And that became the most popular plan in these companies. And as one worker said, he told me, I never wanted to go into a doctor's office because I felt like I was getting in a train where I didn't know the destination and I didn't know what it was going to cost me. And I was terrified of ever going in there. And this allowed them to be able to say, okay, I know at least, I don't know where the destination goes, but I'm not afraid of it, right? Because I know I can come in the door and afford what it might require.
Just one more question, I guess, and I want to get into USAID. How did Medicaid expansion affect things. It seemed like it was very popular, and especially in these red states who came to it late.
Medicaid expansion was crucial to the success of the Affordable Care Act. It became a benefit that was not just to people below the poverty line, but people up to four times the poverty line, which still didn't quite reach the middle class, but reached a large portion of the low-wage workforce. And not everybody, but it meant a world where having access to Medicaid is a system without a copay, without a deductible, without coinsurance, without a premium, and, you know, has been incredibly popular for that reason. It's a state-based single-payer system. Sustained rural hospitals, sustained communities and people across the country who could never have enough money for the high deductible plans that are out there. And it has saved lives. So, you know, the Medicaid expansion has been demonstrated now, and multiple studies have substantially reduced, to have significantly reduced mortality, to have reduced depression and improved financial outcomes for people at the bottom end of the income scale. Healthcare is one of the most important and powerful things you can do to improve people's not only survival, but their quality of life and their ability to live closer to a middle-class life.
Okay, let's move on to your service during the Biden administration. In November of 2020, President Biden asked you to be on the COVID-19 advisory board. When was the vaccine approved? It was just right after the election, I think.
The vaccine was approved. The results came out right around just after the election. That's right. And very rapidly, starting in December, started rolling out in the elderly populations and the high-risk folks like healthcare workers as well, first responders, in those first couple of months.
How many people did you get the vaccination into in your time there or in the first year? Biden wasn't president yet when you joined.
That's right. So Biden was inaugurated January 2021. I was offered the opportunity to lead Global Health USAID in April. And the rest of the year I spent in confirmation with Marco Rubio had opposed me, accusing me of being an abortion an infanticide advocate. That's what he tried to portray me.
So you believe that even babies that are just born,
that's right, infants should be put to death was the claim, and despite there being nothing whatsoever that could suggest that that was the case, eventually I got through in December of 2022. So when I took the job, the president had gotten through the American Rescue Plan, which paid for vaccination across the United States and also donated vaccines to the world, up to a billion vaccines. You know, when I was asked about the job, there was going to be $19 billion that I could allocate and drive out into the world. And instead, I arrived there and that had been spent. But the job was then now get these distributed. And distributing 700 million vaccines, supporting countries to get them into arms everywhere from the archipelago, the islands of Indonesia to the Sahara Desert was what I got to oversee and work with a whole lot of people do at USAID, along with CDC, DOD, and others. And it's like nothing you've ever seen, bringing these vaccinations to the world. And so many people did it to get it here in the United States.
So when did you join USAID?
So I was sworn in at the beginning of January 2022.
Okay, so that's hence 3 years.
Yes, right. I was there 3 years until the transition.
I think your title was Assistant Administrator for the Bureau of Global Health for USAID.
Correct. Basically, I got to oversee our global health work. I had 2,500 people, about 900 in Washington and 1,600 in 65 countries around the world. Had the budget of about half of my hospital system in Boston.
Wow.
And we reached hundreds of millions of people and saved lives by the millions. And it was, it's the best job in medicine that no one's
ever. It's kind of a dream job for you.
It is. The scale is like nothing conceivable, and the opportunity for impact. This was, you know, 20 million people with HIV and ensuring they get life-saving medications, stopping malaria, trying to eradicate polio.
What was the range of stuff the USAID did?
Yeah, so the core of the work is reducing premature deaths, which I measured by tracking that. The measure of that was reducing deaths before 50. The percentage of deaths in any country before 50 was goal one. And goal two was stopping deadly diseases around the world that could threaten the U.S. and the world. And, you know, so a place like Ukraine was February 24, you know, of 2022, a few weeks after I was sworn in. I expected the COVID job. I did not expect that I'd be on the border in Zhiziv, Poland, to oversee plans around how we were going to help keep the health system alive. And in Ukraine, Russia cut off its access to medicines. So pharmacies for the entire country lost access to medicines. Most of them were shuttered in the initial week of attacks. Hospital systems were under attack, not just with bombs, but also cyber attacks had taken down the electronic systems of the hospitals, and they bombed the oxygen supplies, the factories that made oxygen.
They bombed the oxygen.
They bombed the oxygen, yeah. And that's when I learned what this agency was capable of. You know, 40 people on the global health team scrambling to safety, and within a week, they're working with the government and had been able to support them to move the entire country's electronic health record system to a cloud-based system that was cyber protected against attacks, able to get a supply chain up and running. You know, more people would die if there was lack of access to medicines than any bombs would kill, you know, get. There were 250,000 HIV patients, a million heart patients, and they were able to fashion a supply chain that was served by now 5,000 humanitarian aid organizations as well as private sector partners, and get medicines to a warehouse in Zhiziv that could get across the border to Lviv, to that could get through citizen transporters putting boxes in the back of their pickup trucks and trunks of their cars and moving them to nodes around the country. And they got 50% of the pharmacies open in that first month, and
wow,
2 months got 80% of them open, and had
wow,
the supply for every HIV and TB patient in the country assured
wow,
for the next 6 months. I mean, it was that capability. The USAID is the largest civilian ground force America has for doing work in our mutual interests and for the development of the countries that we partner with. And that, you know, what they call soft power is just simply being able to get stuff done that range, you know, our goals from stopping HIV to keeping the energy program, you know, energy supplies going in Ukraine.
So more than just healthcare.
Yeah, far more than healthcare. The biggest component of USAID is the Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance, which is basically the FEMA of the U.S.'s FEMA for disaster around the world and global health. Those are the two largest, and they are somewhere around a little over half, I think, of the budget. But then you also have programs around agriculture. You know, this is the agency that helped move countries like India from being chronically famine and food aid dependent to being an agricultural exporter.
And how did USAID do that?
Trained thousands of agronomists in India, helped bring the technical know-how of the green revolution and support and loans that could help farmers get, you know, the investments needed to make that go well. In fact, that's the kind of thing we did so that, you know, the majority of our trade partners, our top 20 trade partners, are ones that once received USAID assistance that helped them achieve economic development. Often it could be agriculture and food-based, but it also goes to developing democratic institutions and financial institutions that can allow them to grow into prosperity.
Sounds like a criminal enterprise to me.
Exactly. Time to feed it into the wood chipper.
That's Elon Musk.
You're quoting.
And you too. The wood chipper part.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Atul Gawande.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ Mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
So you turn in your resignation, and how long did it take Musk and Trump to attack USAID?
It took about 4 days. The initial move, there was an executive order that pulled the United States out of WHO, and it had a wrinkle because the normal part of pulling, in order to pull out of the World Health Organization, Congress had stipulated that it needed to be a one-year process, a kind of waiting period before you could do it. And so Trump had added on that all funding immediately stopped that goes to WHO. Even any support for active emergencies that were underway, including an Ebola outbreak in Uganda at that time, a Mpox outbreak killing children in the Congo.
What is that disease?
Mpox, that what used to be called monkeypox, but got renamed since it doesn't actually come from monkeys.
Okay.
And so, you know, the WHO pullout seemed alarming enough in and of itself, right? Trying to wreck an institution that eradicated smallpox in the world and is on the verge of eradicating polio. But then he also had included what sounded like a kind of not an abnormal order that said foreign assistance, new disbursements and contracts in foreign assistance were ordered to be stopped. And that's not totally unusual that you say, I'm not going to make any new commitments until we've reviewed policy and that. But then Marco Rubio, who just got sworn in that week as Secretary of State, put out an order on Friday the 24th that was a stop work order that said not only are there no new contracts or commitments, but the existing payments and commitments needed to stop immediately. Didn't matter if the medicines were on the shelf or the food for starving children are on the shelf.
Now, is your suspicion that that order came from Trump and Musk, or that Rubio had this?
I to this day, I mean, Rubio signed it. To this day, I'm uncertain because he seemed genuinely shocked by the consequences of it. And I, you know, the pattern has been across the government that Doge, Elon Musk, has been the driver of taking the chainsaw to entire agencies. And this is in line with that.
Well, let's talk about the consequences that he was shocked about. How many during those 3 years that you were at USAID, how many lives did USAID save?
So we actually quantified that during my time there, the countries where we worked had at least 1.2 million lives saved from work associated with work that we were doing. In addition, there were there was a vaccine campaign and set of work underway to that was in the midst of expanding, reducing measles and addressing HPV for every 70 girls in low-income countries who are vaccinated against cervical cancer from HPV, one life is saved. It's one of the most life-saving things in our portfolio. That's HPV, so it's human papillomavirus. So there's a bunch of vaccine programs we had that would have saved an additional 8 million lives over the next 5 years. So, you know, massive impact underway. 20 million people with HIV on medications supplied by the United States. And all of it suddenly was suspended and paused, making it sound very benign, like a just, you know, hold on just a minute. Mm-hmm. But this is like stopping a plane in mid-flight for a pause. As would happen, they purged the staff. So you're firing the crew and then expecting not to have a catastrophe.
How many people worked in USAID?
So if when you include the contract workers, about 13,000 people, most of them working abroad. You know, it started with 58 people in the top leadership who were initially purged in the first week, then terminations of the contract workers, which were several thousand people. Half of the Global Health Bureau disappeared in that first 2 weeks, and then ended with 2 weeks ago now a final termination of virtually every single person left in the agency.
And what happens to those people? They're overseas. They're serving in third world countries in many cases.
In the beginning, it was extremely chaotic because many of them were immediately put onto administrative leave or terminated, and they did not have access to, they didn't have plans for how to return home. You had people with medical issues not being addressed.
Well, you shouldn't feel sorry for them because they're people involved in a criminal enterprise.
Right. You know, as one of them said to me, you know, she said, I don't, my kids are in school. I have no understanding. Am I pulling them out of school? I have no understanding of what my future will be. She said, my country is attacking me. It's frightening inside USAID. We should be ashamed of ourselves. Our system of checks and balances have been broken. In some countries, they were doing work, upholding human rights, addressing, challenging corruption, and now we're being faced with genuine attacks. And it was terrible. Now, the plans got, you know, over time they learned a little bit and got the plan so that they now have an exit path of they're leaving by July 1 or September 1 and are being sent home and then and fired. It is slightly more humane than it was, but it's also illegal. This is a agency constituted in law by Congress, and it's going through the court processes, but it's already dismantled to a point that it's not going back to the way it was before.
Now, I think you said that your budget was half that of your hospitals.
That's right. Half of my hospital systems.
Okay. So a lot of people think that the United States spends an incredible amount on foreign aid.
That's right.
In terms of a percent of the budget, what are we talking about?
Here's the better way to express it. So it's like 0.35%, but that doesn't help you, right? So the average American has $14,600 in taxes in 2024. The amount that went to USAID is under $50.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of what we get for that, you get control of an HIV epidemic that is at minuscule levels compared to what it was before. We had control of measles, where we've had for going on two decades elimination of measles in the country, only we're now seeing outbreaks that have reached so far 20 states and now three deaths.
Three
total deaths now, two children.
At first, Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy Jr. wouldn't say you got to get vaccinated. He finally has, I think. He went to a service or a funeral for one of the children who died in Texas and said, get vaccinated. But that took him a while.
And we're all fixated on whether he says it or not. Here's what would have happened, what would have happened when I was there 3 months ago, would have happened in any administration. You would have all of the different agencies meeting on a weekly basis. You'd have the Secretary of Health and Human Services meeting with the public health directors of the states on a weekly basis and coordinating a response that got vaccination rates up in vulnerable communities and, you know, got the messaging across, taught everybody repeatedly, and offered the chance for vaccination to children who are at severe risk. You know, this is primarily in communities that are below 90% vaccination. Some of these communities, often religious communities, are, you know, in the 20% range of vaccination. And and working with local clerics, working with communities, you can get these vaccinations up. This is what we did at the beginning of the Biden administration. There was a polio outbreak in Rockland County, New York, in a Orthodox Jewish community that was very set against vaccination, but with patient and concerted work coordinating across the U.S. government repeatedly, you know, it wasn't just what somebody said once or twice at a funeral, right? They mm-hmm. were able to bring support that got vaccination happening and stop the polio outbreak. That is not what's happening now. And that's the alarming thing, is that the normal functions have been decimated and the leadership is not taking the actions that could stop this. And we could lose our malaria elimination status, which means that to go into countries with that, if we lose that status, then to travel into places that don't have measles anymore, if we lose our status, then travel, you know, becomes an issue for people.
So it feels, I've known you for a while, and you seem, I'm getting a different affect from you than normally. Normally you're pretty upbeat, and this must have been just knocked the stuffings out of you.
Yeah, I would say so. Look, this is an enormous, this is a massive loss of life that is already underway. I have a daily conversation with people in countries around the world where they're saying to me, you know, just from a conversation yesterday, that they have a community health worker who has been working in a community where U.S. assistance has meant that HIV has been under control. One person who had HIV had it for 10 years and has been under control, got TB and was able to get the TB treated, but lost access to the medicines with the suspension of aid. The HIV surged again in him, meaning he could transmit as well. But that took, you know, that killed his immune system. The TB overtook him and he was gone, just like that.
And there's no, gee, if I could talk to Rubio, gee, if I could only talk to Musk, or, I mean, that's stupid.
There's,
what I'm saying,
there's no sense that anybody has really taken seriously the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of deaths that we are projected to be facing in the course of the next year. That there have been for 3 months total cessation of malaria programs as we're going into malaria season, TB back in surging, the biggest infectious disease killer, setbacks in measles around the world. You know, measles were back, we were already back up over 100,000 child deaths a year globally, and looking at that to increase. And they're defunding core programs where the U.S. has led the way in bringing many countries around the world to improve, increase vaccination, support vaccination to happen everywhere, lower costs, and enable countries to stand up their health systems to get better results. The alarming thing is the gleeful indifference to the loss of life and the mismanagement of billions of dollars of funds.
The gleeful indifference.
Yeah. Yep. Gleeful joy in smashing the system down and destroying the careers of people in the process as well.
Let me ask you about Harvard and the administration going after a lot of funding at Harvard. I think they're talking about cutting because of anti-Semitism at Harvard, cutting up to $9 billion in funding. That's a lot of money, and that's research, right?
Yeah. So I can't speak for the university. I'm not a spokesman for the university, but I will say that the pattern has been that it was $400 million in grants at Columbia, $800 million at Johns Hopkins, $9 billion at Harvard. And they are attacking the universities for what, you know, on sort of trumped up charges, but it's in order to punish these universities and try to severely damage them. The funding is predominantly research funding. It's cancer awards, it's Alzheimer's disease, it's maternal mortality work, it's across the board. It has no connection to what the claims are. And more to the point, it's part and parcel of a project I actually see as very connected to what's happening at USAID. The playbook at USAID was finding out the systems that you could use to terminate contracts, purge staff, tear down programs, offices, remove buildings, etc. That's been then applied now at NIH, at CDC, at FDA, and to universities. And it is putting into place political controls over what were otherwise independent agencies that were deliberately protected when they made choices like what kinds of research to recommend, what kinds of FDA approvals would be had after the research generated drugs and devices and solutions. And then the guidance that CDC sends out and then the deployment that Medicare, Medicaid, USAID have for the United States and abroad. And that whole system, that infrastructure of health and science that added 30 years to Americans' lives and the world's is under severe attack right now. It's not just losing a generation of scientists. It is abandoning a critical engine of our prosperity since World War II.
So
it's hard to be upbeat.
I hear you. I hear you, but there's gallows humor, I suppose. There's always that.
There is always that.
Yeah. Thank you, Atul.
Thank you. It's great to get to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, man.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
Thank you. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.